Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrn, a potpourri podcast by me, veterinary ethologist Myrn Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed.
We all like it when good behaviors become habits. But what about when those established behaviors become problematic later? That question occurred to me when I overheard a woman in a supermarket explain how she broke her dog of his nasty habit of jumping up on people. "I gave him the down command in an authoritative voice when he jumped on me or someone else," she told her friend. "When he obeyed, I gave him a treat. After a few weeks, he did it every time." "So that's how it's done," her friend exclaimed. "My neighbor's 8-year-old dog instantly obeys the down command when he jumps on people. I always wondered how she taught him to do that." Does anything about this human-canine behavioral sequence strike you as problematic? That depends on how the dog owners defined the problem they wanted the training sequence to address. If they defined it as a need for the jumping dog to drop like a rock every time they gave the down command, then their approach makes good sense and addresses the problem. However, that assumes that nothing will change in the owner's life that would negate this thinking. Is that a safe assumption to make? Suppose the owner or some who visit her develop medical or other conditions that make a dog trained to reliably abort a jump a hazard. The fact that the dog jumps on command means nothing if the jump itself startles someone and causes them to lose their balance or even fall. In this scenario, the training sequence initially described makes no sense because the problem isn't that the dog won't stop jumping on people on command. The problem is that the dog jumps on people in the first place. Further complicating matters in this scenario, if the jump aborting sequence has become a habit for owner and animal by the time this challenge arises, both will need to work harder and longer to learn the new behavior. Unfortunately, in situations where once acceptable behavior becomes problematic because it poses a danger to others, the pressure to resolve the now redefined problem behavior immediately may be great. Let's consider another example of an habituated human-animal behavioral sequence that later created problems. This one occurred early in my veterinary career. A client I'll call Ms. Person was blessed with an incredibly intelligent cat named Calvin. Within today's training community, Calvin would rank as a very food-motivated animal. Consequently, if someone asked Ms. Person how her and Calvin's elaborate feeding ritual came about, she was hard-pressed to describe the exact process. I could say Calvin started it because he jumped up on the chair next to me when I was eating my dinner, she'd explain. He looked so darn cute sitting there like an honored guest that I gave him a piece of my baked chicken breast and he took it and ate it very politely. When he did the same thing the next day, I decided it would be fun to train him. Ms. Person then read several books on clicker training and cat training, and over time, she and Calvin created a complex feeding ceremony. In addition to sitting politely next to her at the dining room table, he patiently allowed his owner to tie a bib around his neck. He had his own plate, spoon, and napkin in front of him. When he wanted something in addition to the carefully arranged dry and canned cat food on his plate, which he nibbled daintily from his spoon that she held for him, he requested this with a soft meow. When Ms. Person gave him something from her own plate, he would gently place his paw on her hand to thank her. After a dessert of frozen yogurt Calvin licked carefully from his spoon, he'd wait for his owner to wipe his face with his napkin and remove his bib. Then he'd go play with his toys or take a nap. All in all, a charming human-animal behavioral display from start to finish. Meanwhile, and in her own reserved way, Ms. Person basked in the attention the feeding ritual generated for her and her cat. The only time I ever saw her laughing was in a photo that accompanied an article about her and Calvin in the local paper. Before she got Calvin and they created their mealtime ritual, Ms. Person was the first to admit that her singular life was acceptable, but sometimes dull and lonely. The trouble began when an old friend offered Ms. Person an all-expense-paid tour of Europe. Because, the friend told her, they enjoyed each other's company, the friend could well afford it, and she didn't want to travel alone. We should all be so lucky, you might be thinking. So did Ms. Person. She readily accepted the invitation and immediately began preparing for this once-in-a-lifetime experience. Naturally, she wanted to be sure Calvin would enjoy himself as much as she planned to during her trip. She investigated area kennels that took cats, chose the best, and arranged 2-day introductory visits for Calvin. Although Calvin appeared normal, he refused to eat anything during those times. After trying multiple kennels with the same result, Ms. Person then arranged for a cat sitter to come to her home and feed Calvin. That didn't work either. Calvin continued to refuse to eat. Other cat sitters experienced similar results. Even though all of these people duplicated the elaborate feeding ritual. The clock kept ticking, and the by-then frazzled owner showed up in my exam room less than 48 hours before her once-in-a-lifetime vacation was due to begin. "Please keep him here. Please teach him how to eat like a normal cat," she begged me. "I love him to bits, but..." Her eyes filled with tears, and her anguish and regret were tangible. I agreed because I felt sorry for her and Calvin. Barring her canceling her trip, staying at the clinic was the best place for him to be. Aside from the usual medical backup the hospital could offer, even back then, the role of behavior in the bond in animal health fascinated me, and I wanted to help them both. For multiple reasons, including the presence of other animals, a supportive staff, and some reasons I never figured out but may have included divine intervention, Calvin gave up the bib and the napkin almost immediately, and even the spoon feeding before Ms. Person returned. In some ways, though, he fared better than she did. Although she tried not to worry about Calvin or feel guilty during her trip, she couldn't. And while she genuinely appreciated that he ate on his own in her absence, I think this saddened her a little too. In retrospect, I think the only reason she didn't resurrect the ritual upon her return was because she realized how vulnerable it made her and her cat when circumstances arose that couldn't support it. These examples demonstrate how, if we know what we want our animals to do and recognize any potential consequences of this before we train the animal, all will be well for both of us. But if we don't, the original behaviors we and our animals learned may become a human-animal behavioral problem that's difficult to change. Experience convinces me that when this occurs, many people have more trouble changing than their animals. Perhaps that's because this means that they must change first, and that may not be as easy as it sounds. We also live at a time when some in the training and bond communities may deliberately or inadvertently support certain human-animal interactions because these reinforce their own views of what's important. Some in the training community may focus strictly on the human skills necessary to ensure that an animal reliably displays a behavior or sequence of behaviors. Those in the bond community may focus exclusively on how much joy doing so brings the owner. But those in both groups can do this without consequences. For the person who lives with and sometimes must leave the animal, getting a broader view of any consequences of the behavior first makes good sense. Because doing so can mean the difference between human-animal bond stability and a bond vulnerable to unpleasant behavioral and health surprises.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore, by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Katova Arts, www.katova.com.